So I'm going to make remarks for about 30 minutes or so, and then I hope we can have a robust discussion. So I'll just invite your questions and comments. So I'd like to thank you, Professor, for inviting me here tonight, and I'm really delighted to join you. I'm here in London this week for the London Conference on Afghanistan, which is being co-hosted by the government of the UK along with the government of Afghanistan. And I'm here with the US delegation, actually the USAID team. And the purpose of this conference is relatively simple. The new National Unity Government of Afghanistan, under the leadership of President Ghani and CEO Abdullah, will lay out its vision for reform for the future of the country. And the international community, including the donor community, is there to show its solidarity with Afghanistan. In addition to hearing from the Afghan government, we'll hear from Afghan civil society, Afghanistan's private sector, and there'll also be a gathering of foreign ministers from countries in the region. And I think what we'll see is a sense of new energy fueled by a strong vision and a desire to deepen what we've called in the international community and I think in the past, mutual accountability, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. So I think London, these 2 days, does have the potential to be transformative that will really set the stage for what Afghanistan calls its transformation decade or the next 10 years of its development. So before I go any further, I'd be interested to know a little bit about who we have here today. No doubt some students, and that's fabulous. Are any of you have worked or lived in Afghanistan? That's great. And how about in around 2001-2002? Great. So I'm really looking forward to getting your perspective on what I'm about to say and to listen to some of your experiences as well. I think that would really help our discussion tonight. So before I delve into the deep past of the last sort of 12 years or so, I think it's important to just acknowledge what happened in Afghanistan in this past year, 2014. Afghanistan had its first democratic transition of power in its very, very long history this year with President Ghani and CEO Abdullah forming the National Unity Government. Some of you here tonight might have been on the ground for that exciting time. The lines were long and the excitement was palpable. And I think Afghans turned out in record numbers that would put some of our more mature democracies to shame. It was definitely a bumpy road. It wasn't an easy process. But the election outcome was settled, and the candidates came to an agreement on how to govern. And on September 29th, President Ghani and CEO Abdullah took their respective oaths of office. But before this watershed moment, there was 12 years of development. When USAID went into Afghanistan in 2001-2002, we were starting from a remarkably, remarkably low benchmark. And that's something I think that we tend to forget and lose as we get caught up in the stories from Afghanistan and our involvement with it. So let's talk about where we began from in 2002. Only 900,000 boys were enrolled in school, and girls were banned from receiving a formal education. Contact within Afghanistan and within with the outside world was difficult. So there were no cell phones. People were walking around with satellite phones in order to communicate. Any form of independent media had been dismantled by the Taliban and its predecessors. If you were an Afghan, your life expectancy was 42 years old. Pregnancies often ended in tragedy for both the mother and the child. Women were largely excluded from public life. Light bulbs was not something you would see on sale in Kabul. It's because access to electricity was minimal and virtually non-existent in the rest of the country. Traveling, even short distances, whether for medical care or for trade, was difficult because bridges and roads were either destroyed or didn't exist at all. And Afghanistan's overlords had really cut the country off geographically, economically, and geopolitically. So that's where we began. In the intervening years, USAID, with our international partners, have made significant investments to rebuild Afghanistan. And we've achieved quite a lot. And I think this is a story that isn't told as often, because sometimes bad news makes better headlines than some of the good things that we've done in partnership with the people and the government of Afghanistan. The investments made by USAID and other international donors have contributed to dramatic progress in health, in education, in gender equality, in terms of the independent media, and the capacity of the Afghan government to deliver services to its citizens. According to the United Nations, Afghanistan has experienced greater improvement in human development, which is measured by health, education, and standard of living, than any other country in the world since 2000. I was going to say that one more time because it shocked even me. Afghanistan has experienced greater improvement in human development than any other country in the world since 2000. That's not a story we hear very often. So let's talk about health for a moment. Afghanistan's healthcare system was rebuilt with contributions from USAID, the Ministry of Public Health, and other donors. And life expectancy, which I have to say, that's health, there we go. And other donors, and life expectancy has increased 20 years. So in 12 years, life expectancy has increased from 42 to 62 years. The under 5 mortality rate has decreased by 62%, and maternal mortality decreased by 75%. On average, 1 million people a month go to USAID-supported health facilities, and 76% of these are women and children under the age of 5. Today, we have 8 million students enrolled in school, more than a third of whom are girls. USAID alone has built or refurbished more than 560 schools, multiple teacher training centers. We have produced and distributed over 148 million textbooks and trained more than 74,000 teachers. The Afghan economy has grown dramatically since 2002. GDP in 2002 was just over $4 billion. In 2013, it was more than $20 billion. And USAID has done quite a bit of work working with small and medium-sized enterprises, strengthening trade, and strengthening agricultural production, which we know is the foundation of Afghanistan's economy. 75% of Afghans rely on agriculture for their livelihoods, and agriculture contributes to more than one-third of GDP. So there's been a lot of investment by USAID and other donors in this sector, from helping farmers create specialized lines of credit, including women owners of agribusinesses, and working with farmers so they can improve the quality and quantity of their products and meet standards so they can actually get them to market. We've worked significantly in the provinces and the regions to build capacity of farmers so that they can produce high-value crops and livestock, again, for local and regional markets. I talked a little bit about electricity and how little there was in 2002. Today, 29% of Afghans are connected to the electrical grid, including more than 2 million people in Kabul who have access to electricity 24 hours a day. For those of you who've lived in other parts of South Asia, you know how remarkable that is. It's not very common. And Afghanistan's national power company, DAVS, is on pace to be commercially viable in 4 years, and USAID assistance has helped DAVS double its revenue collection, which is building sustainability into the system. So it means that people are paying for electricity, and that's going to sustain the electrical grid. Again, for those of you who may be familiar with other parts of South Asia, that's something that doesn't happen very often. Telecommunications. According to the Center for International Media Assistance, at least 61% of Afghans own a mobile phone, and 80% of women have access to one. This is a really interesting part of the Afghan economy because with donor assistance, but also through a really active private sector in this area, telecommunications has flourished. Telecommunications is now Afghanistan's greatest source of foreign direct investment. It's the largest remitter of taxes to the government, and it's the biggest licit employer. So it's really interesting to see in such a short time technology really making such an important economic contribution. And it's technology that connects Afghans to each other, but also to the world. USAID has also supported the emergence of Afghan's now thriving media. Again, there's incredible private investment, but Afghans in the room or people who've been in Afghanistan know the Mobi Group, Tolo News, and the many other TV stations, hundreds of radio stations, daily newspapers. This is a really active sector, and it's really interesting. If you don't subscribe to one of these news feeds, I suggest you do, because it's good news. Beats the Daily Mail. On gender equality, women have made incredible strides and have done so with tremendous courage. In the 2014 elections that I just talked about, women represented more than 35% of voters. USAID interweaves women's empowerment into all of our programs. And what we see is this helps women and girls gain education, health, but also independence, and the ability to start on taking roles in all sectors of society. Lastly, I'm going to talk about government capacity, and that's something that is invisible and hard for people, I think, sometimes to envision, but it doesn't mean it's not critical or it's not crucial. USAID and other donors have worked very closely with key ministries to train civil servants, in part so that they can do things like increase revenue collection, which supports the fiscal sustainability of the country, and also to improve service delivery to citizens, so things like health and education and things like that. USAID has trained more than 16,000 civil servants, 26% of whom are women. And we're also working to help develop a centralized customs revenue collection system. And domestic revenue has increased from $6.7 million in 2008 to $1.9 billion in 2013. We've had a dip this year, I will admit, over the election period, but it still shows that the capacity and the potential is there. So this is a great foundation, right? Fabulous statistics, lots of good news. But we know that there is so much more that needs to be done and can be done. And I think what we'll see in London is President Ghani really championing a very ambitious reform agenda. And he's been in office for just 2 months, so it's something to keep in mind when we look at what he has done. So he's really trying to take action to demonstrate to the international community and to Afghans that he's serious about tackling corruption, improving financial management, promoting economic growth, including strengthening ties within the region and strengthening society. So I'll just give you a few examples of some of these things, and I warn you, some of them are a little wonkish and technical, but nevertheless, if you're in my line of work, you do think it's cool, I'll admit. So within 3 days of taking office, President Ghani reopened the Kabul bank case and ordered a retrial of those accused of fraud, and a special Afghan court issued a new verdict for two main conspirators and froze the assets of shareholders. Here's the wonkish bit. The new government revised and improved its anti-money laundering and combating the financing of terrorism law. And this was to the satisfaction of an intergovernmental organization that oversees these things globally called the Financial Action Task Force on Anti-Money Laundering. And in October, they actually upgraded Afghanistan's standing. Afghanistan is looking at its mining law so that it meets international standards, so that it attracts legitimate private investment to help develop that so far nascent, but what could be incredibly important to Afghanistan's economy. At the World Bank fall meetings just a few weeks ago, Afghanistan and Pakistan signed a transit fee agreement for Castle 1000. those of you who've not heard of CASA 1000, it's a World Bank-led project that's designed to sell excess summer hydropower from Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, transit it through Afghanistan, and get it to market in Pakistan. It's an ambitious project, and Afghanistan and Pakistan agreed on their price for the transit fee a few weeks ago. But what's important about this project, more than creating potential for a regional energy market, is geopolitically significant, because it means that Central Asia and South Asia are coming together, and Afghanistan is serving as this envisioned land bridge for this transit of electricity. So the fact that other countries are coming to the table to agree and negotiate these price purchase agreements and transit fee agreements is really important. President Ghani has taken the steps to reform the Attorney General's office and has promised to make new appointments to the Supreme Court, including a female Supreme Court justice. He signed the Access to Information Law, which supports open media. And what's really interesting is Rula Ghani, the First Lady, has taken on the role of champion of women. And that's really unusual in Afghanistan, to have a First Lady have such a public profile. She's already made an impact on the world stage, making remarks at the opening of the Symposium on Afghan Women's Equality and Justice, which was just a week ago. President Ghani also realizes that Afghanistan's fortunes are tied to its neighbors and vice versa. This idea of a land bridge that I just mentioned, seeing at recasting Afghanistan instead of the war-torn problem neighbor as actually a viable economic partner and a viable transit country, that changes the whole game, I think, for Afghanistan. He's already made state visits to Saudi Arabia, to China, to Pakistan. And I think we'll see more along these lines in the coming days, as Prime Minister Sharif is expected to join President Ghani this week in London, something that would have seemed impossible just a few months ago. So are there challenges ahead? Absolutely. Collectively, I know that we realize how far we've come from such an incredibly low base. These ambitions are not without considerable challenges. The poverty rate in Afghanistan remains unacceptably high at some 36%. Many children still do not have access to basic education. Not enough women are enrolled in higher education institutions, own their own businesses, or are in decision-making roles in government. Afghan men and women graduating from college often do not have jobs to go to. And Afghanistan faces serious fiscal challenges, both in the near term and the longer term. Corruption is a stubborn thing. And most importantly, the achievements of the past decade can slip away if we're not resolute about protecting them. So where are we headed, and why is the London Conference on Afghanistan so important? First of all, I think it's a chance for the world to hear more about President Ghani's vision for Afghanistan's next decade, which is one which USAID welcomes. He has called his paper Realizing Self-Reliance, Commitments to Reforms and Renewed Partnerships. It's a pretty meaty title, and I think it says a lot about the principles that are being set forth. And we do have to remember this is a long-term vision. These things are not going to happen overnight. By setting out a plan for long-term economic growth, Afghanistan plans to take the lead on its own development and over time reduce the need for extraordinary levels of assistance. USAID remains committed to Afghanistan in the goals that were set forward in the Tokyo conference. So that was 2 years ago and preceded this London conference. And we're committed to maintaining and making durable the gains that were made in health, education, and empowerment of women over the past 12 years, working to mitigate the impact of the drawdown and the instability of the election period through a robust focus on agriculture, private sector development, operations and maintenance of infrastructure, and supporting responsible development of Afghanistan's extractive sector. And we're also committed to working with the government directly to continue to build its capacity to serve the Afghan people. Afghanistan is setting the stage to transition from an economy that President Ghani has described as underpinned by aid and military expenditures to one he describes as a vibrant, functioning, real economy. So this means an economy that creates jobs and attracts private investment. And it's one that links markets from Central Asia to South Asia and really reestablishing that connectivity in what now has become one of the least connected areas of the world. So let's talk about trade for a moment. We know that the vision is for free flow of goods, and Afghanistan being a country that one can go through, it's not the only route, to get from Central Asia to South Asia. And so it's important to have a good trade policy framework, and it's also important to work with other countries in the region on their trade policies to harmonize things like tariffs, to reduce barriers at customs and those kinds of things, which is something USAID is taking a leadership role on in the region. We're also working with the Afghan government to ease accession into the World Trade Organization. And we're working with other donors and other governments to help develop bilateral and multilateral trade agreements with Central Asia republics and Pakistan in particular. Private sector growth is also important. So we've talked about agriculture, we've talked about small and medium-sized enterprises. So USAID has a particularly strong track record in this area. So in the past, we've worked with the Afghan government to launch 88 public and private sector partnerships, leveraging more than $130 million in investment across a range of industries, including construction, food processing, consumer goods, media, and things like that. And we're also supporting mobile money and mobile deposit and payment systems as an innovative way to expand access to finance for the population, but it's also a way of reducing corruption when payments can be made directly to police officers or teachers. Agriculture is clearly underpinning the economy. Look at that grapefruit. it's actually, for those of you who haven't been to Afghanistan, it's amazing to drive by the roads to see these stalls just filled with all of this beautiful produce. But there's some really technical things about being able to export this kind of thing. So things like sanitary and phytosanitary standards. Those have to be understood and adhered to in order to access markets abroad. So there's some real technical knowledge and capability that has to be built into systems, and working with farmers and distributors is a part of that. There's also a lot of legal and regulatory reform in extractive industries, for example. So helping the Ministry of Mines and Petroleum have the capability to manage contracts and to have a fiscal regime that makes sense, so revenues are captured ultimately for the benefit of the Afghan people. In energy, one of the things USAID is doing is we're working to develop the Shebergane gas resource, which is near Mizar, which will ultimately bring power to Mizar and the north. And we're also working to extend the country's power grid south to Kandahar. So these are all big, big visionary kinds of projects that take some time to come to fruition. I think gender equality is something that the Afghan government recognizes it cannot afford to roll back on. So I think when Ghani talks, he really is very strong about how Afghanistan cannot afford to marginalize women, and that the education of women and girls is one of the country's proudest achievements. I think we'll see this government being very stalwart in terms of keeping and advancing the gains for women's equality. USAID recently launched its largest gender program in the world, in Afghanistan, so in the world. So it's a big effort and a big commitment. It's called Promote, and what it intends to do is work with these girls who are now young women coming out of the education system to help them become entrepreneurs, decision makers in government, and community leaders. And the ambitious program seeks to work with 75,000 young Afghan women to help them become leaders in these fields. So I'll talk a little bit now about mutual accountability, which is a very sort of donor-ish kind of term. But I think it's important as we work together for this transformation decade, because what it means is that the Afghan government and the international community are accountable to one another and to the Afghan people to implement reforms and to provide the support to help that happen. And that's no small task. So this will be discussed in London, and what I'm hoping is that we'll see civil society organizations seeing a role for themselves in this mutual accountability process, so it really starts to strengthen the voice of civil society in this dialogue. And what happens after London is important too. So London is a political moment for Afghanistan, and it's a symbolic moment for Afghanistan. And after that, the sleeves will be rolled up, and there'll be an intense period of work, working with government and donors and civil society and the private sector to really prioritize this ambitious reform agenda, set out the short and medium-term priorities, and then for donors to look at how they're going to support this agenda that's set out. So keep, watch this space for mid-2015, when I think there'll be a lot more, technical information and really sort of, there's a strategy. I consider this the operational plan, part of how we get there. So this is what we're doing here this week in the London Conference on Afghanistan. The National Unity Government will signal that they will take ownership and responsibility necessary to achieve what they see as important for Afghanistan's future. And it's a vision that fuels our continued partnership with Afghanistan and its people. Afghanistan's neighbors will be there to underscore the importance of regional economic ties. Afghanistan's civil society and private sector will tell us their views on what Afghanistan can be. And the entire international community will reaffirm its partnership and commitment to set the stage for this next period of transformation, this next decade of development in Afghanistan. In closing, I'd like to return to where I began, which was the elections in 2014. The Asia Foundation recently released its 2014 survey of the Afghan people, so I'm sure a number of you are quite familiar with this survey. But it found that a major driver of national optimism in this year's survey was the presidential election. Two-thirds of respondents said the presidential election will make their lives better. That's a huge level of expectation to fulfill. But I think it also says something else. It says to me that despite over three decades of conflict, the Afghan people remain resilient and they remain hopeful. And that's a good message to bring to world leaders this week in London. Thank you, and I'd like to chat with us.
Thank you very much.